Welcome to Let's Finally Watch This, a podcast for casual movie fans who have always meant to watch classic movies. I'm your host, Nick Hayden.
And I'm your other host, Timothy Deal.
And this is the last movie of season three, Tim.
We made it all the way. We're here in 2014.
This is our 34th movie?
Yes, that's right.
Nice.
Very good.
We're a third of the way through 100 movies.
Wow.
Most of them, which we both had never seen. You've seen a few more than I have, but...
But yeah, here at the end of the third season, crazy to think how many movies we've been doing this for.
Especially when we weren't sure we were going to have a third season.
Yeah,
so we're like, hey, we'll wing this thing. Let's do this.
That's true. 2014. That's the other weird thing about this, though, Nick. Can you believe it's been 10 years since 2014?
Yeah.
That sounds strange.
It does sound strange. But I got to the point where everything is longer ago than I thought it was.
Yeah. 2014, I was beginning my 30s and was kind of sort of established in a career. It would go through some ups and downs before between here and now, but you know, I was knee deep in the YouTube world.
Yep.
And this time working at the job I was at.
I had two kids by this point, but not Mercy yet.
Yep. No Mercy.
Yes. Yeah. No Mercy rule. So what movie are we watching in 2014 here, Tim?
We are tackling the Wes Anderson directed movie, The Grand Budapest Hotel.
So we have changed. We had changed our movies a couple different times for this one. Should we mention that now or later?
Yeah. I mean, only just in the sense of I think we hinted earlier that we might have more Clint Eastwood this season.
Yes.
And clearly we are not.
So we had three choices for this episode.
As usual.
And we were going between this one and American Sniper.
Yeah. And I think actually now you mentioned that I had put out on Facebook our list and we originally had American Sniper as the last pick for the season.
But we'd like to have a good variety and we'd had a couple war-ish movies.
Seven Samurai, just a number of violent,
more violent. And this seemed like Grand Budapest Hotel. It seemed like the sort of quirky we hadn't had this season.
Yeah.
So we went with that.
Kind of a last minute audible. We had always kind of kept it open just in case and we went in case.
Yep. There we go.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
We went in case.
Whatever the case may be. It's an airplane for some reason. Anyways.
But was it the right choice, Nick?
We will see.
Okay.
But before that, let's talk a little bit about, just recap our kind of our 2010s thought process from last couple seasons.
We've mostly focused on technology because, again, we don't have a great term for the people have been calling it the blockbuster age ever since 1984, apparently.
So it's been like 40 years of
blockbusters franchises. I mean, granted, I think that it went through seasons. We saw a lot of sci-fi in the 80s and then 90s, actually a pretty good variety of different types of blockbusters.
And then superheroes.
And
like trilogies, like you had Hunger Games and Harry Potter and all that.
Right.
Franchises.
Went more into franchises starting early to mid 2000s and continuing on.
And I feel like looking back, we're going to get to the streaming age where like it got fractured a lot because of Netflix and stuff.
But yes.
we're still in it, so it's hard to know
right
how it's going to look.
Yeah, exactly. And we've talked about indie markets are still around, but our main focus has been a lot of on where technology has been at because we saw a lot of experimentation with 3D.
Mm-hmm.
I did check today, Nick. Our local theater, NCG, the 8-screen theater here in Auburn, is not doing any 3D movies.
Okay, they were like just a couple years ago.
Yeah, not too long ago. None of the ones currently being shown are. In Fort Wayne, at the Regal Cinema, at least, I didn't check the other one, but at Regal Cinema, the only movie currently in 3D is Venom.
Okay, interesting. So it's kind of fallen out.
It's fallen out of favor. I thought for a while it had completely vanished, but apparently not. Like if you look up like a list of 3D movies on Wikipedia, you'll find basically all the blockbusters will still do a 3D transfer, but it's not nearly as common or as marketed as it was.
And for a while, I guess this would be a little less than 10 years ago, maybe. They had a lot of push for IMAX sort of movies.
Sure, sure. And again, the major blockbusters for this year, 2014, had a lot of 3D. And sometimes they weren't necessarily shot in 3D. They were filmed in 2D and had an after conversion. But it was still the case. I think they were still kind of pushing it, but it was already fading out at this point. We've talked before about how Blu-ray had won the format war, but we're already having competition from streaming. So Blu-ray never really became as dominant as DVD did. That being said, I was kind of surprised to find that in this year, 2014, Netflix started streaming some of its shows and movies in 4K.
Okay.
And so did Amazon toward the end of the season. Again, they're not, Netflix isn't full-fledged into producing original programming yet. They've, right now, they're still kind of focused on House of Cards and Orange is the New Black.
Early big hitters.
Yeah, the early big stuff. As the decade goes on, yeah, they'll just pick up steam and be making all kinds of stuff. But yeah, it's kind of startling to me to realize that 4K is already getting all the way back in 2014, especially since the conversion from analog TV to digital really only happened like 5 years before this,
yeah,
in 2009. I did ask one of my brothers-in-law not too long ago, who's more of a techie than I am, is 4K really, like, has it kind of hold mainstream? He's like, yeah, most TVs you could buy, like, if you go to buy a flat screen, 4K is very affordable. So if you're in the market for a new TV, you're probably going to get one these
days. Interesting.
So, which I did not realize just how, because I bought my last TV like 9 years ago. So
from mine forever ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently it is more mainstream than I realized.
It's interesting with technology. I don't know if this comes into play, but it seems like they're experimenting with the format. And I feel like even Grand Budapest Hotel is experimenting with the look of stuff still.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's not the same as 3D, but it's still that sort of like, we're so confident in our technology that we can play with the...
like even the aspect ratio.
And stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. Honing in on the happenings of 2014 in film at the box office. So this is going to be an interesting topic of conversation. The worldwide, top of the worldwide box office this year was Transformers, Age of Extinction.
Okay.
Now, I will note, though, that is different from the domestic box office here in America. The top grossing film in America was American Sniper.
That went like crazy. Like, they went much better than most people thought it was going to go. And it got an audience that were different than most blockbusters.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely some people who are interested in patriotic war movies that wouldn't, not even people that would necessarily always come to a Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah.
Went and saw that one.
I just remember even news articles back then just talking about the different. It pulled different people to the theater that had normally gone.
Yeah. And when I was comparing these numbers, I was also realizing just how much of a difference the global marketplace was than comparison to, as a comparison, if we go back to the last episode, last decade, the films are pretty similar for the worldwide and the domestic. Yeah. For example, the top grossing we said was Shrek 2, which pulled in over $935 million. In the United States, Shrek 2 is still the top and pulled in $441 million.
Okay.
So you got like a difference of about, that, yeah. About half of it. In 2014, Transformers Age of Extinction got over $1.1 billion in the worldwide box office. The top film of the domestic was $350 million American Sniper.
So the overseas film industry is becoming bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Now, is that, it seemed like, I don't know my timeline. There was a spot where China was starting to allow certain American films.
Yeah, that I did just a little bit of research into this, not a lot. But yeah, in 2012, the Obama administration signed a thing with China to allow more U.S. films into their country. So that's happening during this period, but I don't think that's the entirety of it.
Okay.
Because if you look at the 2011... compared to the 2011 two different box offices, the global and the U.S., that's before then, and there's still a pretty big difference.
I suppose there's just, I don't think it's probably been so much here. It's probably a lot of those growing, like, second world, like India,
I think
parts of, you know, South America, China's probably part of it.
Probably.
Just more exporting of American pop culture.
Yeah, and the big spectacle pictures are going to be more likely to get those things.
But that's what the other nations aren't making, the ones that,
are that scale.
Yeah.
And most of the top 10 of the global versus the American are pretty similar. There's just a few that are different. Like the American list includes the Lego Movie and Big Hero 6.
My guess is American Sniper did not make a ton globally.
It did not even show up on that list.
Maybe they didn't even send it out of America. Because
I don't
know. A lot of times when they send movies out into the world, they make it less strictly American. You know, they'll change flag. Like, I've seen like Toy Story, like they'll change the flags from Buzz to Speech and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's possible. And I guess I should note, Transformers Age of Extinction at $1.1 billion became the 10th highest grossing film of all time.
Okay.
I don't know that anyone remembers that.
Yeah, that's one of those that like...
Although Transformer movies just kind of blended together. And
yeah, after a while, I'm just like, who cares?
I only ever saw the first one, and that was because I was like, I would like to see giant robots fight on a big screen. I've never seen that before. And then once I saw that one movie, I was like, okay, I'm good.
Yeah, I might have seen one more, but mainly the first one, yeah.
Yeah. But to kind of put ourselves in perspective what was going on in 2014, the other big blockbusters that we would know, The Last of the Hobbit movies, Guardians of the Galaxy was this year. That came at number 3 in the global box office. The first of the Mockingjay movies.
Okay, yep.
And coming in number 10 in the global box office, Interstellar.
Okay. So mostly fan franchise then Christopher Nolan, which is basically how movies have gone for the last 10 years.
Pretty much. Yeah, that's looking at this list, that's exactly what you're looking at. I will also note one other notable movie that came out this year, not in the either top 10, but was a franchise starter, John Wick.
Oh, okay.
The first John Wick movie came out, which I still have not seen, but I know it's a phenomenon.
Exactly. It is now. And it's kind of grown over time.
Yeah, I think through word of mouth, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. At the Academy Awards, the best film went to Birdman.
Which I've heard of.
Yes.
But yes.
Full title is Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Okay.
So I've not seen it. And
was it our third?
That was our other. That was our other nomination for this episode. Best director went to the director of that movie, Alejandro G. Iñárritu. I'm sorry, my Spanish is out of practice. That he won the best director for that. Best actor went to Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything, a biodrama about Stephen Hawking.
Okay.
And best actress went to Julianne Moore for Still Alice. I don't know that, but
I don't know that either.
But she apparently swept a lot of awards.
Good job
that year. So good job, Julie.
We're always congratulating these best female act. You know,
best actresses who we don't know anything about.
Good job, guys.
we're
super movie buffs here.
Yeah, yeah. That's why it's called Let's Finally Watch.
Exactly.
This.
We're learning, guys.
We are. Well, I guess we've already covered our nominations for this episode, so.
Let's talk a little bit about Wes Anderson, then.
Okay.
Because he's one of those names that, as a director, we're aware of, being, like, casual movie fans. Like, we're hardcore casual movie fans. But, like, he's one of those names that I've heard, but know very little about.
Yeah. So, Wes Anderson got his start in the 90s. He made a short film, I think, as a college student with his roommate and his brother, Luke and Owen Wilson.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's an interesting roommate collection going on, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, and also Owen Wilson shows up in this.
That's right. Owen Wilson became one of Wes Anderson's standby. Okay. He has a kind of a pool of actors he likes to pull from frequently. But anyway, so they did a short film that got picked up by a producer. It got shown at Sundance somehow, and that they made the full-length feature out of that called Bottle Rocket.
Okay.
Now it's Owen and Luke Wilson's debut film in 1996. And that kind of got his start. Scorsese was a fan of that stuff.
Well, that's a good thing to do.
Yep. He went on to do Rushmore in 1998. And then in 2001, his big box office success was The Royal Tenenbaums.
All movies I've heard of.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But never seen.
Yeah. And so that kind of started his career. He's known for having a very quirky visual style.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I might just read a little bit from the Wikipedia article on him because it might be easier to summarize. According to one author, Anderson has been noted for extensive use of flat space camera moves, such as pans, tilts, zooms, within scenes that look two-dimensional.
That's also true from the one we watched.
Symmetrical compositions, snap zooms, slow motion walking shots, a deliberately limited color palette, and handmade art direction, often using miniatures. These stylistic choices give his movies a distinctive quality that has provoked much discussion, critical study, supercuts, mashups, and parody. Many writers, critics, and Anderson himself have commented that this gives his movies the feel of being, quote, self-contained worlds, unquote, or a scale model household.
I think that's a good summary. Even of Grand Budapest Hotel, it just feels like it's his own thing. Like it's not trying to be realism. It's trying to be, it's its own self-contained world. Yeah.
Yeah. A Wes Anderson film kind of has gotten a reputation for having a visual style as distinct as, say, a Tim Burton movie.
Yes.
Like you say, oh, that looks very Tim Burton. You can look at one of his movies and it's like, oh, yeah, that looks very Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
No, the one movie before this you had seen was The Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Which has a distinct style, too.
It does. And it also shows his penchant for stop motion. I mean, that whole movie is stop motion. Even some of his other ones that aren't stop motion, he'll wind up using.
Which I think there's a little bit in this one.
I think there is a bit in this one, yeah. Thematically wise, I'm going to also read this, and I don't often read directly from Wikipedia, but this is...
It's better than us trying to hammer it out.
Yeah, exactly, since I don't feel like I haven't got a good grasp on him. This is only the third movie of his I've seen myself. So, Anderson's work has been classified as postmodern on account of his nostalgic attention to detail, his subversion of mainstream conventions of narrative, his references to different genres in the same film, and his love for eccentric characters with complex sexual identities. Anderson has mostly directed fast-paced comedies marked by more serious or melancholic elements, with themes often centered on grief, loss of innocence, dysfunctional families, parental abandonment, adultery, sibling rivalry, and unlikely friendships. His movies have been noted as unusually character-driven and, by turns, both derided and praised with terms like, quote, literary geek cheek.
Yeah, even a lot of those themes show up in the one we watched.
Yeah.
So yeah, so someone's right on in this sort of analysis. I've not seen, how many movies does he have, approximately?
Good question. Let's see. I think there's about 20 here. Let me do it.
Okay.
Oh, I take it back. Only 12 currently.
Okay. So you've seen a fourth of his.
I guess so. Grand Budapest Motel is considered by many one of his best. It was nominated for 9 Academy Awards. It won 4. Those for being Best Costume Design, Best Makeup and Hairstyling, Best Original Score, and Best Production Design.
Okay, which I can get behind that.
Yeah, yeah. It was also nominated for Best Picture and Best Director and Screenplay, but it was not, did not win those. But it is still very highly regarded by critics. It currently has a 92% tomato meter reading on Rotten Tomatoes based on 319 reviews. And it did win all kinds of other awards. Actually, there's a whole Wikipedia page for allocades received by Grand Budapest Hotel. And they count up among all the different like award shows and things that it got 163 different nominations.
Wow.
And won 67 of them.
Wow.
So
that's interesting.
So it's been called a lot of people consider it Wes Anderson's magnum opus, apparently.
Okay.
And it has appeared on rankings from BBC and IndieWire as one of the greatest films of the 21st century. Again, we're not that far into it.
But they have the film web pages and magazine pages.
Basically. And the Writers Guild of America did a 101 greatest screenplays of the 21st century so far. They literally put that in parentheses. And on that list, this movie is ranked at number 25.
Okay.
So, like I said, the two Wes Anderson movies I had seen before this were Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which is kind of a takeoff on Cousteau.
Cousteau, yeah. The Jacques Cousteau.
Aquatonaut or whatever you...
Yeah. Aquanaut?
Aquanaut, yeah. And The Fantastic Mr. Fox. And Life Aquatic is quirky, but seemed to mask a deep sadness, and which I would also kind of ascribe to this movie. And honestly, one reason why I haven't gotten around to watching a lot of Wes Anderson movies is going through undergrad and then grad school, the kinds of film students I always saw that were really taken with Wes Anderson often seemed to be the kind that I didn't share a lot of similar tastes with.
Yeah.
They tended to be the... they're attending a Christian school like I was, but they're definitely leaning more progressive. They're the kind of student who's more infatuated by Rob Bell than C.S. Lewis.
Okay.
And I was always on the C.S. Lewis Chesterton side of things and not interested in Velvet Elvis or those other like hot, like, oh, let's question whatever the evangelical church is doing right now.
Yeah. If there's a debate, the church is wrong and the new people are right.
Yeah. 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 A lot of that kind of person winds up being in film students, or I don't know if the love of film engenders that in a lot of Christian students. I don't know.
That's a discussion for Dear Old Trains of Thought.
Yeah, actually. It's a different...
I have opinions, but...
Yeah, but anyway, that being said, and I don't know if that's a completely fair bias to have against Wes Anderson himself. Like, it was like... Well, these people are interested in that kind of movie, so maybe it's probably not what I'm going
to do. It was a knee-jerk reaction to it, and there's other movies to watch.
Yeah, that's exactly true. That being said, when I heard that our frequent guest on the Weekly Hijack, another one of our podcasts, your sister-in-law, Brianna Hayden, was a fan of Wes Anderson, I was like, okay, I got to see. Because he does have a very distinct visual style. Like, I enjoy some Tim Burton occasionally. Yeah. So, like... maybe I should give this another shot and see what it's like. So
this is a good time to do it. Good time to do it. And we fill a niche that we did not have this season.
That's right. Exactly.
So let's give a quick summary so we can get to our discussion. I think you and I are jumping the bit to discuss this movie.
Probably. I wonder what the listeners are hearing in between the lines here. But this movie starts with... Well, very strange setup. So it starts with a woman checking out an author's bust and reading one of his books.
Called the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Called the Grand Budapest Hotel. It cuts then to...
the author himself.
The author himself, played by, I'm trying to remember his name, Tom Wilkinson.
Okay.
I just mentioned it because I've seen him in other stuff. Basically setting up the stories. Like, as a writer, you will meet people. So then we flash back to him as a writer, as a younger writer, being played by Jude Law.
Yep.
Who's at this rundown hotel, or like it used to be a grand hotel, the Grand Budapest Hotel, no less. But it's in the 1960s now at this point, and young Jude Law encounters the owner, Zira Mustafa. They get into a conversation in the sauna, and they wind up having dinner together. And he tells them the story of how he obtained the Grand Budapest Hotel, starting back in 1932.
So there's like literally in 5 minutes, there's like three layers of like, person doing story. And again, we'll talk. I don't understand why exactly. I got some ideas, but.
Yeah. So we've got a story within a story.
Story within a story, sort of. It's just like, yeah, you know, when you go to Pirate World and you want to hear about.
all of our Santa Claus and the Ice Cream Bunny fans are be screaming right now.
Anyways, I'm off track.
Easy to do. So we hear about how this man, Zero, was a illegal refugee, basically hired to become a bellboy for the Grand Budapest Hotel while it's in its glory, in its glory days. And we learn about how he is first interviewed and then taken under his wing by the main concierge of the hotel, a man named Monsieur Gustave, who is very precise in how he wants his hotel run, and he teaches them how to anticipate the guests' every whim and need before they even know it. Mm-hmm. But we also find out how Gustav is a very eccentric womanizer of sorts.
And kind of insecure, but that comes in later.
So he...
But he cares about all his guests, but he also womanizes them simultaneously.
Yeah, and he specifically has a type. He tends to woo fellowly insecure old ladies.
Blonde
old ladies. It's a very... Who are rich, yes. It's a very...
But he's not strange. He's not a gold digger.
Apparently?
Well, kind of. It's hard to tell, because he goes to go visit... Lady dies.
Eventually, yes. One of his many conquests, lovers...
It's hotel weird. Guests, I don't know.
Yeah, however you want to call it. She dies, and he immediately drops everything, goes with his protege, Zero... Yep. To her manor, basically to say pay his final respects, but
and possibly get something from the will.
Possibly. He does wind up being there right during the will reading, and it turns out that this lady has bequeathed unto him a very famous Renaissance painting, a fictional painting, but apparently...
Boy with Apple.
In this world, a very sought-after painting.
Yes.
And the family is incensed. I think it's implied that this woman's son is a mafia leader of sorts or organized crime or something.
He talks like one. Yeah, it's Adrian Brody.
Yes.
Yes.
You'll notice there's a lot of stars in this film, some playing big roles, some of them just
random.
A cameo.
Yeah.
Again, that's a Wes Anderson thing. He likes having these big casts of famous movie actors because apparently movie actors really like working with him. Anyway, so Gustav goes and steals this painting because the son is not about to let him have it, but it's like, it's mine. And it's very valuable. I'm getting out of here. So they steal the painting, head back home, hide the painting in the Budapest Hotel. Then the police show up because apparently they believe that this lady has been murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Gustav is a prime suspect. So,
and then it kind of goes on through a series of escapades, I guess.
Yeah, I mean...
He gets arrested, and then there's
the big jailbreak, and then there's lots of running from, there's an ongoing thing with the son sends out his hitman played by the Green Goblin himself.
William Dafoe.
Yeah, thank you. I had to look it up. The attorney is played by Jeff Goldblum.
For whatever reason.
Playing it surprisingly straight.
I expect him to be a little more crazy, but he was very straight.
Yeah. To help them escape, the concierge, Gustav, contacts. Apparently, there's a legion of concierges.
Yeah.
Secret organization.
Yeah, the organizations of the Cross Keys or something like that.
Yeah, that help him out and all this. So lots of escapades, again, of like trying to evade the police. I say police is really more like a pseudo. This is all taking place in a fictional European country in 1930s.
So pseudo Nazis or Russians. It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Fascists.
Yeah, fascists of some sort who are on his trail.
Exactly.
And also trying to avoid the hitman of William Dafoe.
Yep.
And yeah, again, like I said, the secret organization of concierges, a lot of them are just random cameos of Wes Anderson staples like Bill Murray.
Yeah. Bill Murray shows up in the weirdest places.
He does. That's just Bill Murray anymore.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that's about, without going through the entire story, I think that's and we'll probably
enough, I think.
Yeah, and we're going over time as it is, which I didn't expect that we wouldn't in this episode, but
a lot of new stuff we've never tackled before.
That's true. That's true. Wes Anderson is a big character, and that whole business with Chinese film industry wound up taking longer than I expected. All right. All that said, are you ready for our discussion?
Sure. Now? We're going to try 12 minutes here.
All right. 12 minutes starts now.
Experience.
Hotel Kinski, kitchen boy, 6 months. Hotel Berlitz, mop and broom boy, 3 months. Before that, I was a skillet scrubber.
Experience, zero.
Thank you again, Mr. Gustav.
Straighten that cap, Anatole. The pleasure's mine, Herr Schneider.
The stress busters.
These are not acceptable.
I fully agree.
Education.
I studied reading and spelling. I started my primary school. I almost finished.
Education, zero.
Now it's exploded.
Good morning, Cicero. Call the clomer.
This afternoon, Monsieur Gustav.
Will that fail, Frau Liebling?
What on earth is this?
Not now. Family.
Zero.
Six, Igor. Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Well, who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir. It's an institution.
Very good.
Okay, you know, it was interesting. When you're reading the summary, I'm like, it sounds really exciting. Except both you and I, at the end of this movie, were just like, what was that?
Yeah.
There's enough stuff that it shouldn't feel like that. And I really don't know why I got to the end and been like, huh? And it just, there's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot of interesting characters. Visually, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But it feels like there's nothing, there's no foundation or weight to it.
Yeah, this was a curious one. After it was done, you and I immediately like launched into this whole like kind of frustrated debate about what was going on, or like not so much what was going on as like, or why it was going on.
Like, what was the point of it going on?
Yeah. I didn't find out till later because Janelle tends to have to go to bed early because of having to get up late at night. She tries not to stay up too late. But it seems like she enjoyed the movie more than we did to a certain extent.
Why did she enjoy it? I mean, what did she enjoy about it? Let's say that.
What she enjoyed was that it was kind of a lighthearted romp, essentially.
And it is.
And I was like, try to compare it to some other things. Like, she knew that the main character was not the best. I think that was kind of one of our early complaints. Early on, I was like, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to like this guy.
I mean, he's complicated, but... Okay, well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and I was trying to compare, it's like, so did you enjoy this more than, say, 42nd Street, which was probably our movie from last season that we had the most trouble trying to understand why it was the way it was. And she was like, yes, because 42nd Street, she felt, was very cynical.
It was.
Kind of depressing in a lot of ways. Whereas this one, even though it has this backdrop of the setting of, like, these fascists and, like, the guy himself is not that honorable, but he is human, and overall the movie has a fairly light touch, even though it has these like moments of sudden violence that kind of punctuate
it's weird. It's rated R, and it's rated R almost simply because every once in a while, I don't know, where it'll be a very explicit thing, whether it's suddenly language, suddenly violence, suddenly some sexual content, and it's like momentary and gone.
Yeah.
And it's like you could have cut out 2 minutes of the film and it would have been PG-13.
Yeah. That's very true. And I can understand her perspective. Part of what was bugging me early on was trying to figure out the why of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
In part because when the movie first started, because like I said, I wanted to like it. I wanted to like see, okay, what's this Wes Anderson guy really all about? And early on, I was really enjoying the visual style because it is very noticeable.
Like, and very distinct. Like everything's centered all the time. I mean, sometimes
the camera is way far back from the action and it takes a long time before you get a close up of someone. And just lots of just different filmmaking choices that you wouldn't do unless you were purposefully doing it.
Yeah. And you notice it, but it wants to be noticed, and it's not bad as being noticed. That's part of the point of the movie, I feel like.
Yeah. I think for a long time, though, I was trying to figure out more of the why of the style. Like, since I compared him to Tim Burton earlier, let's compare it to, say, Big Fish.
Yeah.
Which is a movie where it has a lot of fanciful scenes, particularly when we're hearing
the story.
The story, the tall tale version of the story. Then in the real world, it's a little bit more grounded and stuff like that. It's a very clear reason for why these things look so fanciful.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of the story. Here, there's not really a reason given for this startling style. It's just there. And on the one hand, it rubs me the wrong way in the sense of, like, there's a certain school of filmmaking where you want the craft to be invisible.
Yeah.
It should all be in service of the story. Every decision should, in some ways, should feel, like, natural to what it's doing.
Yeah. I feel like it's more of a Spielberg style, like.
Yeah.
So later on, you're like, oh, wow, he did all that, but I wasn't paying attention because I was wrapped up in the story.
Yeah. I mean, that's more classical Hollywood style in a lot of ways. But if you're making the choice to do this in this very stylish way and not really for any particular story reason, old classical Hollywood style would go against that. But then I was like, but maybe it's like fashion. I always remember going to a museum of art one time as a homeschool field trip, and all these homeschoolers are asking them, like, why are you doing this modern art? It doesn't mean anything. And the guy being like, well, your clothes are kind of abstract.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of fashion is just plain colors. Like, why do you enjoy wearing plaid? I don't know. I just do.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see there being a defense for this stylistic choice here, but, like, watching the movie, I was too distracted by it.
The modern art example, I think, goes with some of my thoughts, because kind of flippantly, I say that it feels like a movie where it's a style in search of substance. That sounds like a knock, and it kind of is, but it's not. Everything's in, I mean, the acting's great, the visuals are great. Like, it's a very, the guy knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But I just, it felt like everything, that all the important things were there just kind of as window dressing, like fashion. Like, even the story seemed like it was partly chosen there just for the feel of things.
Uh-huh.
It felt like a movie that was more like a vibe than a plot.
Mm.
And for me, that doesn't work. Now, maybe it does with some people. You know, maybe they just, like, I really vibe with that vibe.
Yeah.
But for me, like, I'm a guy who wants to, again, like, the characters are interesting. Like, the plot is interesting. Like, there's nothing wrong with the plot. There's nothing wrong with the characters. But they always feel so manufactured that you don't feel like there's a, for me at least, that I could, like, grab on and be like, that there's a foundation or a meaning or a reason for all this chaos.
I will critique the main character a little bit in this. Like I said, early on, I had a really hard time liking the guy.
Okay.
Again, because of the, I mean, it's not like you can't have a character. I mean, James Bond is kind of a womanizer, but we like him because he's protecting the free world.
Yeah.
This guy, early on, I was having a really hard time getting a read on him of, like,
who's Gustav H?
I'm afraid that's me, darling.
What are you doing here?
I've come to pay my respects to a great woman whom I loved.
Call the police. We're pressing charges. This criminal has plagued my family for nearly 20 years. He's a ruthless adventurer and a con artist who preys on mentally feeble, sick old ladies. And he probably f***s them, too.
I go to bed with all my friends.
At first, he comes off as abrasive, as bossy, as, like, he does this elaborate lectures for all the other bellboys and hotel staff. And later, I was like, okay, I guess that is supposed to be endearing in a way.
And I wonder if it's supposed to be more funny than we found it.
Yeah, I kind of suspect so. Sometimes I felt like they were trying to do sort of like a Phileas Fogg sort of character with this.
Yeah.
You know, someone who's very extremely driven and very focused.
And a little
very
pompous about it.
A little pompous.
Without knowing he's pompous.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very specific way. And, like, Phileas Fogg is full of himself, but he's also kind of endearing just because of his own direction.
Mm-hmm.
And a certain kind of inner nobility. Gustav is so ridiculous and out there, at least in the first half, that it was kind of hard for me to empathize with him. Now, in the second half, the more you see his genuine affection for his protege,
That's one of the better parts of his character.
That really humanizes him, I felt.
I see. So you're actually really more of a refugee in that sense?
Truly.
Well, I suppose I better take back everything I just said. What a bloody idiot I am. This is disgraceful, and it's beneath the standards of the Grand Budapest. I apologize on behalf of the hotel.
It's not your fault, Monsieur Gustav. You were just upset I forgot the
perfume.
Don't
make excuses for me. I owe you my life. You are my dear friend and protege, and I'm very proud of you. You must know that. I'm so sorry, Zero.
And after I got that better human connection with him, I thought it was a lot funnier, honestly. Yeah. I said this last season when we talked about Mabel's new hero.
Yes.
Where, like, I really want to love the character before I can really laugh at them.
Yeah. And I think most humor is out of enjoyment of something, you know. Yeah. You got to enjoy the character. Just making fun of him cynically is,
yeah,
is title humor, but it's not one that you and I like much.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that was a big problem in the first half.
And the ending's kind of awkward just because, like, it's just randomly tragic.
Yeah.
And again, it fits the rest of the movie. It's just, you know, everything just is just a little off. And maybe that's just a kind of different conventions. I mean, you have those four layers of storytelling, side of storytelling, which is interesting, but, like, is that supposed to mean this idea that just, like, nostalgia and time passing and you have different eras? And I mean, it's all that, which I can read into, but I feel like it's a movie that once you do bring meaning into it versus having, I don't know. Maybe that's not fair either.
Yeah, it's tricky. I had to look up, I was very grateful to have Janelle's input in this because I wanted someone whose worldview I trusted to kind of bounce off of, who enjoyed it more than I did. But I also wound up looking up, and I don't often do this, but since I couldn't find it was just the first Christian publication I could think of, Plugged In.
Okay, yeah.
I looked up their review of it. And I like this, what he said at the end. These scenes, like all of Anderson's, are flecked with an almost desperate pathos that looms behind the whimsy as he suggests that all good things do indeed end. The movie's philosophy is summed up smartly, if obscenely, by Gustav himself talking to Zero on the train.
You see, there are still faint glimmers of civilization left in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity. Indeed, that's what we provide in our own modest, humble, insignificant... Oh, fuck it.
Yeah, there seems to be something in that, of this yearning for a more civilized time, for a more grand... Like, it hints at, like, what the Europe of our imaginations, of what used to be.
Yeah, in living that, I think it was inspired by writings of a... I don't remember who.
An actual concierge or something?
No. Someone who wrote a lot about kind of the grand old days of Europe. Like, you see what it was inspired by this writings of this, I wish I remember the author's name, that talked a lot about kind of that old style Europe. And I think Wes Anderson and his co-writer, maybe, drew a lot of inspiration about the look and the feel of the world from that. So, again, that's part of what we're going to say is this style that, for me at least, was looking for substance. It's like, it's that feeling of old Europe. And then... fascism, you know, this Nazi-ish thing coming in, and then time going by and losing it, and those themes are all there, but it didn't resonate with me at all. It was something I was watching, like, from the outside. I don't know why exactly.
Yeah, it's a curious thing. It's one of those, like, I can see pieces, but if for some reason, for you and me at least, it wasn't gelling.
It didn't connect. Like, you can see the pieces, but, like, it just, maybe it was his style, maybe it was the fact that, like, it was randomly, like, violent or cartoonish sometimes, and I feel like the way it was filmed overshadowed what the film was trying to do. And maybe I'm wrong, but for me it did.
Yeah. So anyway, there's our time. This has probably been the most disappointing or confusing movie of the season, and I hate to say that because, like we've said, there's a lot of interesting ideas here, and Wes Anderson is clearly someone who knows his craft.
Yeah, he's obviously talented. Everyone involved in this thing's talented, but at the end, you and I were just like, What was the use of that?
Yeah. And maybe because we were overthinking it in some ways, but like, I don't know, but they're...
But we'll watch one and just be like, oh, that was just fun. And it wasn't quite that either.
Yeah.
And there is kind of a sadness behind it, but there's also just we're out of 12 minutes, so I'll stop trying to find words for what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well, hopefully at least we've given you a sketch of our working through all this. You and I are usually pretty nice and pretty... open to these movies. Like, we don't tend to, like, want to bash these things.
No, like, if there's, like, even the ones we make fun of, like, Gangs of New York and 42nd Street, like, there's things they're doing well.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways, this is more coherently trying to do something well that, like, I feel like Gangs of New York, for instance, was all over the place. You know, anyways.
Yeah.
But this was just a weird beast. And you and I were both kind of on the same page on it, so it's not like, I just didn't like it, you didn't like it. Like, there's just something... missing for what we felt like it was trying to do.
Or at least what we were looking for.
What
I was hoping.
So what is our recommendation here, Tim?
I don't know.
It's kind of a meh. I don't know. It's...
Like I feel pretty meh about it. Like I said, my wife enjoyed it, which surprised me. I thought going as we were watching, I thought she was bothered by things because she tends to be a little bit more than I am about certain things. But she enjoyed it. So, I mean, again, it's R-rated. I'm always a little skeptical of R-rated comedy stuff in general because who knows what
but
that
means.
But
it's weird. But you could take 2 minutes out. It'd be almost fine.
Yeah.
It was random.
If it was like, this would almost be one of those you, what are they, like a Vid Angel?
Like this Vid Angel one did wonders for this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it just is.
Yeah, I'd be very cautious about who I recommend it to.
I think we'd recommend most of the other movies this season before this one.
Yeah, probably.
So, I mean, just for the casual movie fan.
Yep.
So, all right. That is our anticlimactic ending. To season three.
We are always bound to have one of these eventually. We've been, as we get into later decades, the ones we haven't seen, there's a reason why we put off seeing it usually. Yeah. So it was either this or really like dark. You know, when we compared the trailers between this and American Sniper, that movie is like almost black and white. It's so desaturated and serious sounding. And this one's like, yay, crazy hijinks.
I have a feeling, well, American Sniper would have been like, it's brutal. But it's really good. Doing if it's anything like other Clint Eastwood stuff we've seen.
Yeah, quite possibly.
But that's
neither here nor there.
Yes. We will have one more episode this season where we kind of wrap up, give you our essentials list. Like you wanted to see, okay, which ones do we really need to see? And then our favorites.
Yes. Because those are two different things.
Those are they are completely different. Well, not often completely different, except for like Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, that's true. Which was just, top of both lists.
Yes.
Yep. I don't know for sure when that's...
It'll be a couple weeks after come out, this episode, at least.
A couple weeks. Probably not as late. Usually do like very end of December. It may not be that late, but probably at least 2 weeks after this episode comes out.
That's good. All right. This has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.